This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello everyone, welcome to the History of Persia. This is episode 166, Meet the Egyptians. Last time we covered the actual action of the Fourth Syrian War. Technically, that conflict started almost as soon as Antiochus III became king. The young ruler got some less than effective advice from his chief minister, Hermaeus, and launched an invasion of Ptolemaic Syria while leaving his subordinates to contend with the ongoing wars in Anatolia and the upper satrapies. That went poorly, and Antiochus turned around to defeat the rebel satrap Molon himself. After the Eastern campaign, Hermaeus was assassinated with Antiochus's hypothetical permission, but the king returned to Syria to finish what he had started, even if he had started it under dubious pretenses. Antiochus very nearly won the war. He had subdued all but a few scattered cities in the north and eastern parts of Coel Syria, and apparently faced very little to no resistance while marching all the way to Gaza. It was all going so well, until Ptolemy IV met him at Raphia. Antiochus's personal section of the army actually drove Ptolemy from the battlefield, but the rest of Ptolemy's Egyptian forces were victorious, helped largely by training the native Egyptian populace and foreign mercenaries as Macedonian-style phalangites. The Seleucid army suffered heavy losses, and Antiochus was forced to withdraw back to his antebellum borders and sign an armistice. The only thing that Ptolemy had to concede was his support for Achaeus, the Seleucid general who had proclaimed himself king in Anatolia, and he didn't get Seleucia Pieria back, the one port city in the Seleucus district. Next time, we will follow up with Antiochus and his rebellious cousin. But today, I am actually doing an impromptu Meet the Neighbors episode. There's just not enough time to wait for Antiochus's death before we need a few of these, and the reign of Ptolemy IV marked a tumultuous era of Egyptian history. To tell him apart in the history books, Greek and Latin authors called him Ptolemy Philopator, meaning the lover of his father. Unlike his grandfather, possibly great-grandfather, Ptolemy II Philadelphus, this wasn't suggesting an incestuous relationship. Just that Ptolemy IV was always his father's favorite son. Perhaps undeservedly so, or perhaps only in the histories. Even as a young man, Ptolemy Philopator had a miserable reputation at the Egyptian court. He was not interested in politics, military affairs, or the actual day-to-day business of running a powerful Hellenistic kingdom. He had a taste for the finer things in life, the luxuries of royalty, and he supposedly excelled at hosting feasts and throwing public festivals. All pomp and circumstance, no leadership. This is a known risk in hereditary autocracies, and any good kingdom will have an administrative apparatus of bureaucrats and advisors that can mitigate a wayward king. But that is still less than ideal and often leads to internal power struggles. We just saw that with Hermaeus and the Seleucid nobility vying for control when Seleucus III and Antiochus were both inexperienced and ineffectual. The Seleucids recovered from that by eliminating the eldest son and discovering that Antiochus was actually a fairly competent leader in his own right. And there are hints in the historical record that some elements of the Egyptian court may have had similar plans for their newest Ptolemy. According to some rumors that made it into the history books, Berenike II, the new queen mother in Egypt, actually favored her younger son, Magas, who was busy leading Ptolemaic troops in support of Attalus of Pergamon at the time. Berenike also had a third son, called Alexander, and one of Ptolemy III's brothers, called Lysimachus, was still alive. Although we know less about the latter two, all three men had legitimate claims to the throne if Ptolemy IV were to meet an early demise. But the nobility of Egypt had other plans. The leading Egyptian nobles at this time were named Sosibius and Agathocles. The latter's sister was actually one of Ptolemy IV's favorite concubines, and the dynamic aristocratic duo quickly set to work establishing their own influence over the new king, and removing any other contenders who might diminish their own power. Magas was recalled from Anatolia and killed in his own bathtub. Alexander was assassinated shortly thereafter, as was their mother, Berenike II. Before long, Uncle Lysimachus was also called back to court and executed on Sosibius's orders. The only member of the royal family who escaped this initial purge was the new king's sister, Arsinoe. But in the long-standing Egyptian tradition adopted by the Ptolemies, and to limit the number of future rivals for power, she was quickly married off to her own brother, becoming Queen Arsinoe III. No sooner was this purge complete than the first events of the Fourth Syrian War began, with Antiochus III's initial attempt to invade. Then governor of Syria, Theodotus was not celebrated for his success. Instead, Sosibius and Agathocles called him back to Alexandria and briefly detained the governor in a not-so-veiled threat that he better not try to use that battlefield success to gain political power for himself. These threats were what eventually drove Theodotus to go over to the Seleucid side when Antiochus returned a few years later. Theodotus was not the only prominent aristocrat to be arrested or imprisoned at this time either. Evidently, Sosibius and Agathocles were determined to lock down anyone who could potentially pull Ptolemy IV out of their influence. To that end, they also had the exiled Spartan king Cleomenes put under house arrest with his friends and allies that had fled to Egypt after their defeat by Macedon in the last Meet the Neighbors episode. In 219 BCE, possibly hoping to take advantage of the royal council's distraction when Antiochus reinvaded Syria, Cleomenes and his friends escaped imprisonment and attempted to rally the people of Alexandria into a rebellion. The local Greeks and Egyptians did not support the Spartan king in any significant number, and Cleomenes, with his followers, took their own lives after a fruitless attack on the city's main citadel. After the victory at Raphia and the end of the Fourth Syrian War, Ptolemy IV's regime took a much lighter approach to foreign affairs than they had under his father and grandfather. This was undoubtedly due in part to the fact that the king had little personal interest and that the nobles pulling his strings were much more interested in increasing their own profile at home. It was also a decision influenced by the sheer unsuccessful nature of previous attempts to control foreign powers. For every Ptolemaic success in checking the Antigonids, the kingdom of Macedon eventually sprung back and defeated Egypt's allies. So when war broke out in Greece again, it happened without Ptolemaic military support and minimal Ptolemaic financial support, if any. This time it was a conflict variously called the Social War of 220 or the Aetolian War, neither of which are unique names, but both describe the situation. A recent war with the Illyrians had caused the Aetolian League to grow stronger as new cities joined the alliance, and they were trying to expand as the city-states of Thessaly turned against Philip V of Macedon. Coupled with Macedon's new Hellenic League after the Cleomenian War from last time, tensions were running high, and since Macedon too had a young and inexperienced king at this time, the Aetolian League thought that 220 was their time to strike. It began with raids in support of Messenia against the Achaean League, and spiraled from there, with the Peloponnesian states of Elis and Sparta joining the Aetolians in their growing war against the Antigonids and the rest of Greece. I won't cover the conflict in much detail, because this episode is about Egypt, and frankly, this particular war has little direct influence on our narrative outside of its conclusion. The war began with an Aetolian offensive on three fronts, sailing south to the northern Peloponnese, while another army came from the west out of Elis, and a third attacked Macedon directly in Thessaly. Philip V responded with a surprise winter campaign that swept through the Peloponnese, but the Achaean League commanders the next spring had much less luck, handing the Aetolians a few victories. When a new old general, Aratus, the on-and-off-again leader of the Achaean League, took control in 217, he managed a successful assault on Elis itself, while Philip V retook Thessaly. At that point, Ptolemy IV, or rather Egyptian negotiators acting on Ptolemy's behalf, got involved to arrange a peace agreement. Combined with news from the West that made Philip think he could expand his influence to a client king in Illyria, called Demetrius of Pharos, this was enough for Philip to enter negotiations. The Hellenic League and Macedon reabsorbed their briefly lost territories, and Philip V was able to leverage this into more direct control over the other members of his league, to the outrage of Aratus and the other leaders of the Achaeans. None of that is deeply important at the moment, it's just information to keep at the back of your heads as the main narrative moves forward. These wars in Illyria and Philip's agreement with Demetrius of Pharos will end up being important down the line. Outside of mainland Greece, Ptolemy IV's foreign affairs mostly boiled down to lavish patronage of allied cities and temples across the Aegean. He sponsored the construction of new city walls for a city on Crete, and funded renovations or donations to a number of temples from Delphi to Rhodes. The news from the West that had taken Philip's attention away from Greek affairs was none other than the infamous battle of Lake Trasimene in Italy, where the Carthaginian general Hannibal Barca had just dealt a staggering defeat to the Roman Republic. And elements of both sides of this Second Punic War also sought help from Egypt. Hieronymus, the new king of Syracuse in Sicily, appealed to the Ptolemy's long-standing relationship with his predecessors and attempted to get Ptolemy IV to intervene on the Carthaginian side. If that option was considered at all, any negotiations collapsed when Hieronymus was assassinated a few months later. Rome also sent an embassy to Alexandria, asking Egypt to supply them with grain, but we don't actually know if that request was successful or not. Regardless, Ptolemaic Egypt did not jump in to this spat between Western powers. They were still much more focused on the Aegean sphere. Domestically, one of the great achievements of Ptolemy IV's reign was an overhaul of the dynastic cult, where the king and his ancestors were worshipped as gods in the afterlife. Over the generations, the cult of the Ptolemies, their various deified relatives, and their queens had grown unwieldy, with many separate cult hierarchies functioning in tandem for each royal couple, as well as several other relatives, and of course, Alexander the Great, whose tomb still functioned as a temple to the deified Alexander in the capital city that bore his name. At this time, Agathocles was the high priest of Alexander the Great. So I suspect the restructuring may have been at least partially his plan. It certainly would have centralized more religious and economic influence under his personal control. The various dynastic priesthoods were merged into a single hierarchy, and the various temple tombs in Alexandria were demolished, with the royal bodies reinterred in a new pyramid-esque structure as a singular royal tomb around 215 BCE. True to his debaucherous reputation, Ptolemy IV also had a preference for the Greek cult of Dionysus, the god of wine and festivity, and the king began promoting several new festivals in that god's honor. He even declared himself Neos Dionysos, a new earthly Dionysus, or perhaps simply the god himself in human form, and had the priests of Dionysus in Egypt submit themselves and written records of their rites for a royal inspection. Of course, that leans heavily into Ptolemy IV and Dionysus's popular image as great figures of debauchery, but think back to my episodes on Orphic beliefs if you can. This would also have been a critical inflection point for the spread of Orphic and Dionysian mysteries in a new land, and a time when those cults would have absorbed many outside influences from other priesthoods in Egypt. It's not just that Ptolemy IV was a drunken, lecherous partygoer. This had very real impacts on the development of Hellenistic religion across the board. In Egyptian religion, Ptolemy IV returned to the old pharaonic standby of the god Horus, the avenging son of the god-king Osiris and protector of Egypt. Horus imagery was almost always incorporated by the ruler of Egypt in some way. It was one of that god's key characteristics. But Ptolemy IV leaned into the role of the avenging son more than many of his predecessors, emphasizing his epithet Philopator as beloved of his father. All of that said, this is still the party king of Egypt, and to that end, he ordered the construction of a truly gargantuan pleasure yacht called the Tessarocontares, a 40-rowed ship that is speculated to be the largest human-powered vessel ever constructed. Supposedly, it was 128 meters long, with a crew of 4,000 oarsmen just to make it move. Modern scholars have speculated that it would have been built like a catamaran, with two separate hulls and a wide deck suspended between them to accommodate all 40 banks of oars. For a comparison, the standard warships, the ones you used to fight other military powers, were still triremes and quadraremes with 3 and 4 banks of oars, respectively. So all told, this would have been more than 10 times the size of an ordinary ship. Again, he was the party king of Egypt. But all good things must come to an end, and Ptolemy IV's endless party came crashing down around 207 BCE when rebellions broke out across Egypt, apparently organized independently both in Upper Egypt to the south and in the Nile Delta. Several temples constructed or undergoing renovation by the Ptolemies were ransacked and looted, which indicates that it probably was not an internal coup by the aristocracy, but a true popular rebellion, likely brought on by the heavy taxes needed to recoup the loss from the Fourth Syrian War and to support the king's lifestyle. Polybius blames this all on the Ptolemies training and equipping large numbers of Egyptians to fight in the phalanx at Raphia. That was not the whole story. As I said, taxes must have risen substantially to cover the war, and Ptolemy IV's reputation as a debaucherous ruler is so universal that it is obviously grounded in reality. However, the training and equipment that the Egyptian soldiers from Raphia received almost certainly played a role because they started winning. In past Hellenistic Egyptian revolts, the populace was disorganized and quickly subdued. We saw that happen with Ptolemy III when he left Syria during the Third Syrian War. In this case, Ptolemy IV and his advisors struggled to regain control of the situation. The Ptolemaic army of Greco-Macedonian colonists was able to reassert control in the Nile Delta quickly enough. That's where they were based, that's near Alexandria, that's where most of the colonies were. But in the south, the rebel army pushed them back and captured the city of Thebes, the traditional capital of Upper Egypt since time immemorial. The leader of these rebels established Thebes as his own capital and declared himself Pharaoh Horwenefer, or Hugenophor in Greek, or Hergenophor in Greek. The Ptolemaic army continued its attempts to retake Upper Egypt from Horwenefer for years with no success. And Egypt was effectively split into separate northern and southern kingdoms for the first time in over 500 years. While these two rival kingdoms, the native rebels and the Ptolemies, fought for control in central Egypt, Horwenefer did not have the resources to fight on two fronts, and a Nubian invasion from the south swept north to retake Lower Nubia, all of the territory south of the first cataphract on the Nile, which had largely been out of Nubian hands since the Persian conquest under Cambyses over 300 years before this. Then Ptolemy Philopator died. One later source mentions a fire in the palace at Alexandria, suggesting he may have perished in the conflagration. It's just as possible that this downturn in Ptolemaic fortunes prompted an assassination by Sosibius and Agathocles, who promptly started plotting to install themselves as the new regents for the king's only son, the new child ruler, Ptolemy V. According to some interpretations, Ptolemy V was actually the son of Agathocles' sister, Agathocleia. But I find that unlikely because the reigning aristocrats had Arsinoe III assassinated shortly after her brother husband's death, specifically to prevent the queen from becoming regent for her son. Sosibius vanishes from the story almost immediately after Ptolemy V was declared king at just 5 years old. And historians generally assume that Agathocles killed his co-regent to seize sole power in Egypt for himself. Agathocles moved swiftly to centralize power, starting with a bribe equivalent to 2 full months' pay for all of the soldiers stationed in Alexandria, quickly winning the support of the army. Most of Egypt's prominent aristocrats were given diplomatic assignments overseas right away, both to secure legitimacy and recognition from foreign powers, and to get those people out of the country while Agathocles settled in. Most importantly, for the history of Persia, the emissary to the court of Antiochus III went to ask Antiochus to maintain the treaty signed after Raphia while Egypt dealt with the transition of power, while ambassadors sent to Macedon and Rome were tasked with seeking foreign alliances against the Seleucids. The idea presented by Polybius is pretty clearly that Agathocles was hoping to delay any Seleucid action for long enough that he could launch his own offensive. But Agathocles overestimated his abilities. despite the bribes when he gathered the army in Alexandria to hear a proclamation about the upcoming coronation of Ptolemy V in 203, the assembled soldiers heckled him off the stage. He also arrested and publicly humiliated the mother-in-law of a general named Tlepolemus, who controlled Egypt's main defensive garrison at Pelusium. This was clearly intended to be a warning to Tlepolemus not to get involved in the succession. But it was not a well-received threat. Instead, when Agathocles arrested one of Tlepolemus's allies in the royal guard and tortured the man, it became the straw that broke the camel's back. Agathocles' mother was attacked by a mob at the Temple of Demeter in Alexandria, and a riot broke out, which soon escalated to the populace of Alexandria besieging the city's citadel. The army mutinied, marched into that citadel, and Agathocles and Agathoclea both surrendered into their custody. They were taken to the city's stadium, where Sosibius's son called for their execution. Meanwhile, Tlepolemus raced across northern Egypt and arrived in Alexandria to seize control of the situation before being declared regent. Tlepolemus turned out to be a better soldier than a regent, though. He spent most of his time sparring and drinking with the other soldiers, and restarted the trend of sending money en masse to their allies in Greece. As public sentiment and foreign affairs turned against him, Tlepolemus was also forced to resign as regent, and was replaced by Aristomenes, an officer in the royal bodyguard who would serve for the rest of the young king's adolescence. Of course, this episode has now carried us well past where we left Antiochus III and the Seleucid narrative in the last episode, over a decade into the future, actually. But given how much of Ptolemy IV's reign was a consequence of the Fourth Syrian War, this felt like the right time to squeeze it all in. Next time, we are back to Antiochus III as he returned from his defeat at Raphia and set his sights on his cousin Achaeus. Until then. If you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the oldest stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.